Welcome to the Global Investor Podcast, a show that focuses on helping foreign investors enter the lucrative U.S. real estate market. Host Charles Carrillo combines decades of real estate investing experience with a professional background in international banking to interview experts in all areas of U.S. real estate investing. Now, here's your host, Charles Carrillo.
Welcome to another episode of the Global Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Charles Carrillo. Today we have Vessi Kapulian. Her background includes 15 years of commercial lending and 4 years of business management experience. Vessi started her real estate journey in 2017, and today she controls a $35 million portfolio of properties in Florida, Tennessee, and Georgia, and just went full-time in real estate as of earlier 2024. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Charles. I really look forward to our conversation today. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I touched on your background briefly, but can you give us a little bit more information about yourself, both personally and professionally, prior to getting involved with real estate investing?
Absolutely, yes. My journey, I could argue, real estate journey really started in Bulgaria, back behind the Iron Curtain growing up, because at the time, and I would say even today, there isn't a very developed stock market. So when people talked about investments, they really always referenced hard assets like real estate, commodities, and such. It was always my dream to come to the US and push through that Iron Curtain. So I learned English, got a scholarship, came to the US, and really I was inspired to follow that American dream. And for a while, I really followed the traditional path of going to school, getting good grades, joining a firm, and climbing that corporate ladder. But it was a few events of adversity, such as the global crisis of 2008-09, my employer going through a couple of restructures that unfortunately left people without jobs, and for some at later stages of their life. And that really caused me to take a step back and pause and ask, am I climbing the right ladder? Is this what really success looks like? And what if that happens to me if I'm 60, facing a layoff or a down market? I realized this is not something I can control, restructures and markets, but what I can control is my investment choices. And so at that point, that seed of real estate finally germinated. I decided to take action. Started small with a single family home investment that eventually grew into a small portfolio. And eventually I decided to, that light bulb went on. Wow, this can be not just a small retirement nest egg as a hedge against corporate events or market events. This can be something bigger and really can turn into a pretty sizable cash flow stream. At that point, I transitioned into multifamily, and now I have the privilege of doing that full time and helping other busy professionals create more optionality in their life and create those additional income streams and tax efficiencies and hopefully live the life of freedom and fulfillment that they dream of.
That's an awesome story. I found that I have some family friends from Eastern Europe, from previous communist countries. And one thing I've seen, and I never really thought about too much, but it's when they did come over, real estate's the first thing they buy, and they would pay it off. I had one friend from Poland, his parents came over, it's like purchased it and like paid it off within like 5 years or 7 years or something. It was like, I'm like, that's not American at all, man. It has to go out like 30 years and refinance it four times. But did you see it too? I imagine you have other friends that have done similar what you've done.
Absolutely, yes. And that's how we are raised. First of all, it's not very common to get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage in actually anywhere in the world. I think probably the U.S. is the only place. And definitely debt is something that we are taught from an early age to stay away from, which I think was great because instilled very good financial habits in me. But down the road, people need to differentiate, right, between good debt and bad debt. And so that was definitely a learning curve for me. But it was role models around me that I saw invest in real estate and hold on to these properties. And that's how they were able to build wealth over time.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us about your transition from residential to multifamily, why you did it, and, you know, what were the main factors for making that choice?
Yes, that's a great question. Once my single family portfolio, residential, because I had some duplexes there as well, once it picked up speed, and my primary objective was also investing for cash flow, because I wanted to create that additional income stream, I think the light bulb went on, wow, this can be something bigger. And then I did the math and quickly realized, wow, I have to buy it, hundreds, literally hundreds of single family homes to achieve that scale. And I took a step back wondering, well, can I do it differently? Is there a more efficient way to do it? And multifamily emerged as a natural answer to that question for me for a couple of reasons. One, I could leverage my background as a commercial lender in evaluating multifamily deals, which fall into the commercial space. Two, I could apply my skill set managing residential properties out of state. And so between the leveraging my historical experience and the desire to scale via partnerships with others is how I ultimately selected multifamily. Basically, wanted to stay in one lane, that's the residential space. Just how I applied was slightly different.
Interesting, yeah. So tell us about your business, what your investment criteria is and your strategy. I know that you do syndications, but you also do joint ventures.
Yes, I definitely wanted to keep the door open for both. And just like even in single family, I started with one single family home before I moved to duplexes. So very similar in the multifamily space. My first deal was an 11 unit joint venture. So I started small before jumping into larger deals, which I'm focusing on today. Specifically, what I look for are good operators with a proven track record, who operate in markets with strong fundamentals supported by population growth, job growth, median income growth, and job diversity, and investing in Class B, C plus properties that are stable value add, so no major repositioning in those markets, with the opportunity to effectively double the invested capital over a five-year horizon. So if the operator, the market, and the deal parameters meet my criteria, then I invest in those deals and correspondingly invite others to do the same if they'd like to.
One thing I mentioned at the beginning of this, which was joint ventures and syndications, can you give us just a quick overview of what the difference is between for people that probably don't know that?
That's a great question. So joint ventures tend to be smaller in size. And for that reason, the team that's required to take down these properties and operate them generally also tends to be smaller in size. So 4 to 5 people that are typically all actively involved in some aspect of the investments, whether it's sourcing, day-to-day management, rehab project management, and such. So for that reason, there is a lot of flexibility, but also generally speaking, there is a larger amount of upfront capital investment required, given that the investment is split among a smaller group of investors that are all actively involved. With syndications, one has the opportunity to scale up those investments and take down larger properties naturally, because they're larger. That typically requires a little bit more work, so there may be a few more people involved on the management team. But by syndications, people also have the opportunity to passively invest. So if they're not inclined or willing to do the heavy lifting and day-to-day management, they can find an operator that they know, like, and trust, and passively participate while enjoying the same benefits of real estate.
Yeah, no, that's a great explanation. One thing you mentioned about being an out-of-state investor, and I know with the syndication, it's a little different because you probably have a team on the ground there, a property manager on the ground there, and that's taking care of a lot of your daily tasks. You have a smaller property, though, which I imagine is a little bit more time intensive on that end, because the property manager is not being overseen. It's literally just, just when you have smaller properties, you usually get pulled in a little bit more in the asset management than you would on a larger property, is what I found. So how can you become a successful out-of-state investor? I mean, how have you done it, and how would you suggest other people to do it?
This is a wonderful question. First of all, you really need to be comfortable with working with other people, because you cannot be boots on the ground all the time. In my case, I live in LA. I invest for the most part in the Southeast. So that's a pretty long flight to be making once or twice a week. So finding a boots on the ground team that you know, like, and trust, and that can be both your partners to the extent you're doing larger multifamily deals, but also your team members, specifically your property manager, contractor, people in that market that can give you feedback on the area. So putting together the right team is imperative to get that done, and really leaning in on others and partnering up with others in order to make this a success. Of course, then that naturally raises the question, well, how can you trust all these people? Well, there is a risk, just like with any investment, that's a risk that you take. So taking the time to vet either the operators or the strategic partners, like property managers, contractors, and so what, asking the right question, asking for references, possibly even seeing some of the properties they manage or the work that they do. There are different things that one can, or steps, action steps one can take to do that extra diligence and vetting on the front end. Of course, it's never perfect, and there can always be surprises down the road. But these are some steps one can take to make to take effectively calculated risk and make that transition from investing in your backyard, which for me wasn't really an option, to investing out of state.
Do you have money sitting in the stock market and you're worried about it? Or worse, you have money sitting at the bank, not keeping up with inflation? My name is Charles Carrillo, founder and managing partner of Harborside Partners. And since 2006, I've been investing my money and my family's money into income-producing properties. These are real assets, real properties with real addresses that produce real cash flow. At Harborside Partners, we provide passive investors who love real estate with a turnkey investing solution. If you want to put your money to work in real estate but can't find deals, don't have the time to get funding, and the last thing that productive people want to do is manage real estate. We find the deals, we fund the deals, and we manage the tenants, the termites, and the properties. Partner with us at investwithharborside.com. That's investwithharborside.com. Go to investwithharborside.com. If you love real estate, you like the idea of passive income, and believe that income-producing properties will appreciate over time, go to investwithharborside.com. That's investwithharborside.com. So you being a commercial lender previously, I mean, tell us how, for people that have never done that, and are coming just from the investor side, how do commercial lenders really evaluate qualified deal operators? And when I was writing this question out, and I thought about for myself, and I would deal with like banks and stuff like that, and was just me as the only person, and you kind of have an idea, but you didn't really get a criteria from them of what they're looking for. You kind of just provide what you have, and hopefully it's enough.
Right. Yes, that always seems like a black box. And in reality, the criteria will differ from lender to lender because they each have their own risk appetite and criteria. But it really boils down to three, I would say, simple things that are very much in line with what we as investors typically look at. First is the people or the operator. As a former lender, I used to say it's people that pay back loans, not properties. And of course, you take the property as collateral. As a lender, you always look to have collateral. But it's ultimately the people that will pay back that loan. So looking at their character, their track record, their expertise, how they've operated similar properties in the past. So that's where it starts first. I briefly mentioned collateral, so looking at the property and the market. Again, those criteria may vary by lender, but for the most part, lenders like to invest in stable markets, areas that are not crime-ridden, properties that are not falling apart or dilapidated in nature, and so forth. Because at the end of the day, if all else fails, that's how they, and cash flow disappears, or the person is not able to fulfill their obligations, that's how they recover the loan or part thereof. And last but not least is the deal and how it is structured, how it is underwritten, what are some of the assumptions that are going into evaluating the property and to figure out if that's a viable cash flowing asset.
When I coach investors, new investors, and they're asking me, and it's usually this, if they're going to a bank, let's just say a commercial lender, and they don't have that experience, okay? It's really, you know, you have to bring in someone, or you have to property manager, right?
Yes.
It's going to be used for it. How do you see that? I mean, how are you vetting that? Someone comes, they have the money, they have deals fine. I mean, everything else checks, but there's no experience. What are you looking at there, and what do you want to verify before approving that?
Yeah, so typically, and you're right, oftentimes people will partner up with other operators who may have that experience or balance sheet strength that lenders are looking for. So understanding, again, the track record of that partner, how well they've worked together in the past, and the nature of the agreement, looking back at the history, do they manage assets of similar nature, right? If you're buying an 11-unit property, that's not the same as buying a 150-unit property or vice versa. If you've always managed 11 units and now you're going into the 150-unit space, or maybe you've been in multifamily and now you're making the jump to new development or self-storage. And again, it really boils down to what lenders are looking for is, how do I manage the risk? How do I protect my downside? And what are the mitigants I can put in place to make me comfortable? Because there's always risk, right? Lenders get paid to take calculated risk. But ultimately, they're looking for, how do I mitigate that operational risk by virtue of the track record of the of that person or that team, and the consistency in terms of historical record.
Yeah, no, great answer. Thank you. One of the things is that over the last 2 years, and this is a question that I bet you've heard hundreds of times, so I'll ask it one more time, is that we see interest rates going up starting in the beginning of 2022. We know that most rate caps in multifamily on floating debt were usually 2, because I know that we weren't getting 3 years because it was always twice as much. And so we're in other operators. So really, it's coming up to that time when this is the year, I think, if anybody got debt in 2022, it is coming up, and something has to be done with it. How are lenders, from your perspective, because I imagine before you left that job, this was a hot topic. How are you guys managing it? Because I was interviewed on a podcast a few days ago, and before the podcast, this operator was telling me that they've had capital calls, but what they've heard with people they've worked with was that a lot of workouts. And so that's what I was expecting, because this is what happened with some properties in the GFC, because they had, they worked out property deals with them and kind of kicking that can down the road. Because I mean, every lender knows that these people don't want to keep these properties forever, right? They're just looking to get out of it, right? And get money back to investors, whatever that might be, and move on. So how are you seeing it on your end? I mean, do you see that lenders will create workouts with, depending on the property type? I mean, please let us know.
Yeah. Yeah. As usual, the answer is it depends. And it really goes back to the three criteria that I mentioned, the operator, the property, and the structure. And so if we're talking about an operator who has a strong balance sheet, can bring additional liquidity to the table if needed or as needed, has been in good standing with the bank, has a good relationship, they will be more motivated to work with you. Similarly, it depends on the condition of the property, right? If it's completely underwater, right? If it's unsalvageable, right? Then that may be more challenging. And at that point, they may be thinking, well, I may just as well cut my losses and move on. But if there is enough equity, if there is opportunity to, like you said, kick the can down the road, they would consider that, again, assuming they had a satisfactory working relationship with that borrower. Because at the end of the day, the lenders are not in the business of running a property, and they're, if anything goes wrong, they're looking, how do I minimize my losses? So if extending that loan by a year, of course, typically with some other strings attached, it's not just a free extension. There may be changes in the covenant structure, liquidity requirements, remargining the loan, which may require bringing in additional equity. But assuming that can be done successfully, pushed through another year, and then able to either exit or refinance on a more stabilized basis, then everyone is a winner. In some cases, lenders will be able to do that depending on how strong their own balance sheet is. In other cases, they may or may not be able to do that. And there are some pretty significant regulations that are coming in place over the next 12 months with Basel III, which will further increase the capital requirements that lenders are required to maintain. It's starting a lot of hot debate in the industry right now. But all of that are factors that would drive the lender's decision. Do I keep it or not? And if I work out the deal, do I work it out with intent to keep it in my portfolio eventually and bring it back from that workout department? Or do I exit because I may be looking at minimizing my losses that are inevitable?
Yeah, and what I've seen when properties, the properties that I've seen for the most part have been properties that maybe were, let's say, less ideal properties, okay? So maybe you had lower C-class properties in C-class areas, which isn't a problem, but the problem is that if it's been over-leveraged and you're not going to be able to get those rent increases. I mean, C-class tenant base has been really hit over the last 3 years, you know what I mean? Since COVID, with inflation, everything that goes with it, it's much different getting rent increases out of those properties versus B-class properties. So that's something I see. I mean, is that really, you might see those banks, those might just get foreclosed right away because there's not really too much of an upside, or it's many years down the road, versus maybe if you had B-class properties where better areas, the ability to really execute a business plan in years to come. What do you think?
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's why I like to say not all lenders are created equal, right? And we saw that in 2008-09 where I was scratching my head in terms of how are these deals getting done? And naturally, there are some people who have maybe higher risk tolerance and were getting more aggressive in terms of the term sheets that were floating around and the deals that they were doing. Then we saw what happened, right? And I think we're going through a similar cycle right now where there were maybe certain lenders who were hungry for risk, willing to overlook certain underwriting criteria, and now their portfolios are in trouble. How long they will be able to sustain that, who knows? But that will also be a driving factor in terms of how motivated they are. If you're just one borrower with one deal, maybe the incentive to work out is not as great, especially, again, if you're unsalvageable, right? But if you're a sizable borrower with 10, 15 different properties, well, that would be a pretty big write-off. So there may be some incentives to work there. But a lot of that, again, will be predicated on the operator, their behavior. Are they in good standing, bad standing with the bank? How deep are their pockets? Because the likelihood is they're going to have to bring some liquidity to the table. And last but not least, based on those two criteria, coupled with the financial condition and the overall risk of the lender's portfolio, and they'll make a determination: do we pause, or do we kick the can down the road? Do we just cut the losses and move on?
Right. So when you're underwriting deals and you're coming with your lender hat and also your real estate investing hat, I mean, how has, you know, we've had rent increases that are, as we read, nationally stagnant. Okay, every market's different, and obviously we're doing value add to these properties, so we might be able to still capture rent increases. But how has your underwriting changed over the last 24 months, let's say?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, because I'd like to also say underwriting is an art and a science, and it's always evolving, right? It's not a static formula that you follow. Sure, there are some fundamental principles you adhere to, but it changes with the market, global economic conditions, and so forth. If you had asked me a year ago, what are some of the changes, it really boils down to five key areas. That's the top line or the rent assumptions, the expense adjustments, the cap rate, entry and exit, the reserves, and then the debt structure. So definitely over the last, call it 12 to 24 months, have really moderated my rent expectations and really aligning those more closer with historical trends. And in some markets, maybe even keeping rents flat or declining, depending, again, on the submarket, because that's a big driver. Definitely making sure I allow ample cushion for adjustments when it pertains to taxes and insurance. And we've been I don't think anyone could have forecasted the insurance crisis that we're now facing. And in some states and in cities, it's more adverse than others. But making sure you adjust for those cost increases up front. And I still haven't quite figured out, more as a side comment, how to manage that insurance risk, because like in Florida, right, it's even worse. So in some states, I have even paused looking into those locations, because I manage the risk premium to some extent, but I cannot manage the risk of being dropped and being without coverage. But then going back to the five steps, as far as cap rates, I personally do believe that we have reached the peak of the rate hikes. And so a year ago, I was accelerating the cap rate reversion rate from the traditional 10-15 basis points to maybe 20-25 basis points. Now I'm moderating that back to the 10 basis points a year, and really looking at a more of a five-year exit cap rate of, call it 6%, more or less. Again, depending on the market. Reserves have proven to me historically that having that rainy day fund has been invaluable with all of my properties. So personally, I'd like to look at 6 months of operating expenses and debt service, and some may call that excessive, but it's proven right over the years. And last but not least, the debt structure, making sure that aligns with the business plan. I've always done fixed rate debt, both on my personal side as well as investor side. So my approach would be, even if that's not available, finding some other mechanism via which to manage the interest rate fluctuation. So if it's not fixed rate, maybe looking at collars, caps, that are maybe other alternatives that mortgage broker or lender can provide. Because again, I would like to focus on running and operating the properties, not guessing where the markets will be 2, 3, or 4 yeah. years from now.
No, that's great. So you left the beginning of this year, you left your W-2 job and became a full-time real estate investor. I imagine you have people ask you how they would do it, or how you would do it again, or how you suggest them to do it. And what would be that advice?
Yeah, so just to be clear, this didn't happen overnight. So I had been investing for the past several years, 7 or 8 years by now. So my advice would be, first of all, determine what your investment criteria are. And people like to take advantage of all cash flow appreciation, tax benefits, but maybe prioritize what is the most important one to you. And then determine what your risk appetite is. Of course, the more risk you're willing to take, the higher the returns. But again, there's no free lunch there. Then select an asset class. In my case, I focus solely on the residential space and eventually multifamily, but that's still within the larger residential family. Select one asset class and educate yourself about it, because you have fiduciary responsibility towards yourself and your loved ones and potentially partners to make educated investment decisions. Find an operator that you know, like, and trust, or partners that you know, like, and trust. And really the last step is take action, because without action, all these goals just remain dreams, unrealized dreams. And the first deal is always the scariest, but you get more and more comfortable over time. So for me, I was doing that on the side for many years, and sure, it involved extra hours after, before and after my W-2 job, but I viewed that as investment in my time and setting up my future, and creating more optionality versus seeing that as a burden or a hassle. But it does take time. So I would advise people, start today, don't delay, and take a small step forward. You don't have to go from zero to hero. Make that first investment, whether it's active or passive, and over time you will get more and more comfortable.
Well, great. That's a lot of great information. So how can people learn about you and your business?
The easiest way to connect with me is through my site, DBA Capital Group, D as in dream, B as in believe, A as in achieve. My contact information is there, a link to my calendar. As well as for the listeners of the show, I have a free gift, which is a complimentary copy to my digital book, The Busy Professional's Quick Guide to Investing in Multifamily, which is designed to empower and educate investors.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, and looking forward to connecting with you here in the near future.
Thank you so much, Charles. I really enjoyed it.
Hi guys, it's Charles from the Global Investors Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you're interested in getting involved with real estate, but you don't know where to begin, set up a free 30-minute strategy call with me at ScheduledCharles.com. That's ScheduledCharles.com. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Global Investor Podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play to get new weekly episodes. For more resources and to receive our newsletter, please visit globalinvestorpodcast.com. And don't forget to join us next week for another episode.
Nothing in this episode should be considered specific, personal, or professional advice. Any investment opportunities mentioned on this podcast are limited to accredited investors. Any investments will only be made with proper disclosure, subscription documentation, and are subject to all applicable laws. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, financial, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own. Information is not guaranteed. All investment strategies have the potential for profit or loss. The host is operating on behalf of Syndication Superstars, LLC, exclusively.